Thank you for joining us, everybody. This week, Wayne White is with me. Thank you for being here in your own home.
Yes, thanks for coming. Mm-hmm. Sorry for thinking you were somebody else.
That's really
trying
okay.
to run you off like the cranky old hillbilly I've become.
You get a pass. It's fine.
And now I do have an open question
yes.
for you. I know it's a little direct, might mm-hmm. be a little personal, uh-huh. but let me just say this to you.
I'm a very sweaty man. I'm sorry.
Is it hot enough for you?
No. No, not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. I'm waiting.
All right. I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Sure. No, thank you. It's beautiful. Will you give me a delightful glass? I appreciate it.
Oh.
There's water in a glass. That's even better. You wanted to talk about Richard Pryor's Wanted.
Yes. If you had to corner me and talk about a record, this was the one that kind of came to me first. It's a pretty obvious one. I mean, this one, pretty famous. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't need me to sing its praises by any means. It's almost like, come on, Wayne, pick something a little more obvious.
You're the first person to pick it, though.
Really?
You're the first person to say, I had to go out and buy this one. Because you're the first person to say, everybody else did, Is It Something I Said or Live on the Sunset Strip.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm, and this is the first double album I think we've ever done on the show. It's super long. Strong 90 minutes of material.
Yes. Yeah, I listened to it again today. And a couple weeks ago too, a few things,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if I'm the oldest person you've ever interviewed.
No, by no means.
But I grew up in the, and this has probably been hit on. I grew up in the age of comedy albums in the '60s and '70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Smothers Brothers, Bill Cosby, early Richard Pryor, even in the '60s, and then of course. The big 70s with George Carlin and Cheech and Chong, and then Richard Pryor again, and then Steve Martin
mm-hmm.
into the 80s. So they were a big deal, comedy albums.
Mm-hmm.
And this one struck me the most because I knew about Richard Pryor and I'd seen his TV show and I'd seen his stuff, but this was the first time I'd ever heard one of his albums. They'd been around for a while. I just never heard one. My friend Bill Kilbrew played this for me in Nashville in 1978. And it just was funny as hell, you know. It was so natural. I mean, the whole structure of the album is basically just storytelling, you know.
Even though,
and it seems to be casual storytelling, but of course it's not. It's all carefully, you know, rehearsed
mm-hmm.
and written material that he makes come alive and seem totally fresh.
Sure.
And that the storytelling aspect of it, it's not jokes or a high concept. It's just him being real human and telling human stories.
In terms of comedy, it's kind of folk art. I mean, it's not something people do as much anymore, telling stories in the same way, you know?
Yeah, Bill Cosby was doing the same thing in the 60s. And even, I just read a book about Richard Pryor. I can't remember the name of it. It's pretty recent. I should have done my homework. I've forgotten the name.
Okay.
It talks about Richard Pryor was a Bill Cosby imitator
mm-hmm.
in the 60s.
Makes sense.
And he does some material on this record that is very Cosby-like.
Definitely.
When he does his kids impersonation,
yes,
very Cosby.
Uh-huh.
And the kids telling the story about how the thing was broken.
Mm-hmm.
It's good though.
Oh yeah,
it's just as good as Cosby's kid imitations.
But yeah,
they both have a total knack for that.
It's true.
So I forgot what I was. What was
well, I was just comparing it pretentiously to folk art.
Oh, folk art.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, yeah, because it's storytelling, and it's not necessarily gags.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that gets its laughs along the way, uses a lot of, almost like radio, uses a lot of sound to,
mm-hmm.
build character and set the scene. Expert sound, you know, the sound of crunching leaves.
Yes.
And, just the sound of different people's voices. If folk art is storytelling, then that's... that's it, sort of. But it's just surreal, you know. He's very vulnerable too.
That was
one of his great. That was one of his great on stage. His on stage charisma was his vulnerability, having a heart attack.
Right.
You know, discussing embarrassing things about himself, showing less than noble aspects of himself. You know, as all the greats do, they show vulnerability. You know.
Which I think is, so it seems to be harder when the person's progressively richer and more famous.
It sure is, yeah.
You know? It's hard to get sympathetic, and he gets the sympathy by just pouring everything on the table, it seems.
Well, and this topic, of course, is a constant with comedy. He had intense pain in his life, and so I think all that pain humbled him and kept him sort of fresh to the pain and fresh to the emotions, and that kind of was communicated.
Yeah.
It was still a tender spot, and he could communicate that just because he felt it too while he was doing it. He certainly makes you feel like he's feeling
it. Oh, definitely.
While he's doing it.
Like, he's laughing through getting beaten. Like, it's just upsetting, that whole sequence, but it's still funny.
There's pain under everything he says.
Mm-hmm.
Intense pain, you know? But it's just, he's a genius storyteller. He's a genius communicator. And he gets that emotion across.
I should probably bring up before we get too far into it that if people don't know who you are, you're an artist. You are a production design fellow. You are a puppeteer. You're a puppet designer. Artist is the easiest way to condense it if you want to condense it. But
yes.
But, you know, if people might have seen your stuff on Pee-wee's Playhouse, Beakman's World.
Yeah, I started out in the TV. I started out as a cartoonist, actually, in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And then became a puppeteer set designer with Pee-wee's Playhouse and got into kids' TV for 25 years, rock videos,
mm-hmm.
whatever, art direction and stuff. Pee-wee's was my big, most famous thing, I guess.
Sure.
And then, luckily enough, I got to change careers 14 years ago and get into the art world and start doing paintings and sculptures and do my own thing. So I've had three different careers like that. So,
yeah.
But it's always, now why did you pick me to be on this show? You usually pick comics.
Usually I pick comics, but the thing is...
Did you see the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That is easily my favorite documentary of all time.
Well, thank you.
But the thing is, when I find myself less than inspired, I find myself low, I genuinely can watch that movie and then immediately want to create again. And
I hope today didn't dispel the magic of that.
No, I think it made it more poignant. I think it. No, not at all. That's exactly why. It's the movie also made me feel like an asshole for not knowing your name. And I like movies and things that do that to me, because, you know, I know Paul Zaloom. Paul Zaloom's done the show, but Paul's, you know, it's just there are other names that just don't come up. And then I see the documentary, I'm like, oh shit, I should have known who this man was.
Well, not really. Most people don't know artists and designers' names.
Sure,
they don't,
but they should.
Well, you have to really dig for it.
Yeah,
and I don't know a bunch of artists' names,
of course,
myself.
But you know the people who have impacted you.
I guess, yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for that.
Of course.
And I guess one of the other reasons that I sort of agreed to be on the show is that I try to go for the laughs myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, in my work. I you know, humor is a big part of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quote that I do in my talks. It's like, I want art to be like real world. I'm not talking about art that's art world funny. I'm talking about art that's real world funny, art that's Richard Pryor funny, if only, you know. So he's always a standard of something that's just bedrock funny, instinctively, you know, universally, incredibly funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Without a real clever concept behind it, it's about just real human stuff.
Yeah,
you know. Not necessarily a clever twist on it, but an emotional understanding of things.
And that was something that struck me about the documentary, too, is when you specifically are talking about that. It's one of those things where, I went to art school, I went to film school, and there's nothing but pretense in the way you're taught, and you're taught by people who are... I don't want to disparage my teachers, but people who are they're working filmmakers, but they're not famous. Yeah. They're not making all their money off of being filmmakers. So their influence to you is to tell you how to do art their way.
Yes.
And how to appreciate art their way.
Yeah.
And you get pretentious. You can sometimes forget the things you absolutely loved about creating, which was just creating.
Yes.
And that definitely happened to me. And there's something about this movie, just a few things you said it struck me, the idea that art can be art and also be genuinely funny. And like you said, it doesn't have to be contemplatively funny where it's just a where it's just a nod, where it's an actual belly laugh.
Right.
And that can be forgotten even in comedy. And
yes.
That's frustrating to me.
I mean that from my heart, because you make me feel good as a person. You know what I mean? It make me say, well, the shit wasn't that bad. All I did was kill a car. Remember, you thought I'd murdered somebody. I thought it was fair myself, you know. My wife was gonna leave me. I said, not in this motherfucker, you ain't. You may be leaving, but you're gonna be walking away from this motherfucker. I'm killing this here. So go get them hush puppies and hit your ass on down the road. I had a Magnum too, man. I shot one of them tires, boom! Tire said, ah! Got good to me. I shot another one, boom! And that vodka I was drinking said, go ahead, shoot something else. I shot the motor fell out the motherfucker. Motor said, fuck it. Then the police came. I went into the house. Because they got Magnums too.
And this album, you know, is a work of art.
Yeah.
And it's funny as hell.
Yeah.
And it's built on, like I said, it's just built from core experiences, fear, jealousy, anger, fear of death, sex, all the core stuff.
Yeah. You know? You remember the first time you heard it. Was this common for you? Were people just, hey, check this album out, let's sit down and listen to it?
Yeah, we used to listen to comedy albums. It was a thing, you know.
Yeah.
If you're a teenager in the 70s, that was one of the main media outlets.
Right.
It was a comedy album. I remember well, yes. And George Carlin's albums were huge.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Cheech and Chong albums, you know. George Carlin was brilliant, you know, but nowhere near as emotional as Pryor.
Definitely.
You know? George Carlin was built on concepts and had a certain amount of emotional baggage from his childhood, but he played it in a more conceptual way.
Definitely.
And which was brilliant, and I love him too. But and then Cheech and Chong was just pure vaudeville,
yes,
you know, for stoners, which had its own charms too.
Mm-hmm.
But Richard Pryor was the one who really, like I said, when something is real, I say it has bacon grease in it,
mm-hmm.
And he had bacon grease.
Do you have a favorite bit off this album? There's a lot of album here, like I said,
yes,
so.
Yeah, although in today's standards, it goes by pretty fast. It does.
Sure.
It's, jeez, I love the thing about the monkeys.
Oh my God! Holy
shit! It's so funny. when the dog comforts him after his monkey dies. You know, what's the matter, Rich? My monkey died. My monkey died. And he's like, oh. I was going to eat them too. I love that dog. He has a real affinity for animals too. That,
yeah.
I love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doing animals and doing animal persona and.
Yeah, it's perfectly natural for him to start talking in the person of the dog.
Yeah, and it's all fluid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Animals talk, snot talks, that he wipes on his shirt, you know. He fluidly uses voices for everything, and they all work,
mm-hmm.
You know. That monkey thing really stands out for me. And of course, things in the woods, nature, the heart attack, dogs and horses. you know.
Yeah, that heart attack thing is, I don't know that I've ever heard anybody describe it in such vivid detail because, you know, again, not everybody survives them. Not everybody makes it through. And
I know,
man,
again, something talking to him.
Yeah.
Suddenly my heart says, stop breathing, you know. He constantly has things, everything talks, everything has a voice.
Yeah, the heart attack almost sounds like the same voice he uses for his dad, too. It's the same tone. It's
true.
And it's kind of, that's no pun intended, heartbreaking. It's just like, oh, shit. Like, those are the two things that hit him hardest.
Well,
his
yeah.
dad and his heart attack.
Just like me and the Southern Daddy Shame Ray that I talk about in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these,
yeah.
These voices of authority and stuff. And I identify that, you know. I didn't have, I mean, his life is tragically crazy. But I do see, you know, the pain of that and of the humor of that. Man, it's what was I gonna say? I mean, everything has the voice, and then what else had the voice? I can't remember. The talking dog is incredible.
It is fantastic.
And so I don't know.
There's a sorry. Your dog is so warm. Poor puppy dog. There's something to be said, I think, for this whole idea that, you know, he's a grown man. I don't know how old he was at the time, but he's a grown man just, I guess this is just common sense, common knowledge, but he's admitting so many weaknesses. The reason you're laughing so hard is it's like, oh shit, even this guy's torn up inside and it's so hard.
And it was even worse than you can imagine.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, this guy was completely out of control. I'm not going to go into all the bad things, but
sure.
It was bad.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he had big troubles.
Mm-hmm.
But he gets at that too in an entertaining way,
yeah.
Without becoming maudlin or anything
right.
else.
Right.
And it was there. And back in 1978, that kind of material was still shocking and new.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a lot of this material that's been copied by so many people that you forget how shocking and new it was in 78. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole white guy voice thing. He was the first guy to do that.
I still kind of like his too.
Yeah. And then everybody did that.
Of course.
You know. But nobody could tell stories like he could. That's your just... Most comics don't have the... You know, he has this... You know, he had the... Everybody knows he has a past.
Mm-hmm.
And so he can, like, be a raconteur, you know. He can, like, talk about his past. Most comics aren't famous enough or notorious enough to spin tales about their past.
That's
like
true.
That. So he has this incredible street rep, you know, before he even gets on the stage.
Yeah.
And this was when he was at the height of that. You know, he'd already been fired from the TV shows and
right.
stuff. And he was a countercultural figure, totally hung out with all the cool guys and stuff in LA. And, you know, was in Rolling Stone magazine. All that
mm-hmm.
stuff was cool back then. So I, you know, I was a slave to the media as every teenager was.
And mm-hmm.
I knew that he was a hip guy. And so... But this record was really, though, the first time I'd heard him on record, besides just seeing his cleaned-up TV routines.
Yeah.
And so it was just like, wow, very, very powerful. And it was indicative of the 70s, too.
Mm-hmm.
Very much about breaking down sexual taboos and racial
Definitely.
Taboos. Again, this stuff sounds tame now, but this was one of the first big mainstream... risky kind of records like this.
Right.
Put out by Warner Brothers Records. You know?
Uh-huh.
Before this, he had had a string of records, but they were like small label things.
Sure.
And they were akin to the Red Fox party record kind
mm-hmm.
of genre. You know, he was firmly in that.
Yeah.
But this was like, this was one of the big crossover records that brought that into the mainstream.
He's talking about faking orgasms, and that's one of the earliest times I think I've, like, you know, on a record that I've ever heard anybody make that joke.
Yeah.
Not just make that joke, but talk pretty seriously about, wait, what the fuck? People can do that? That can happen. I just love his childish surprise. That's just that mix of that childish surprise, dropping N-bombs left and right, swearing left and right, talking about getting hit by his dad, but they're still just like, wait, no, I still want to be a kid. That's in there.
Yeah.
That's in there. I am a kid. There's some shit I just don't know.
There's this undeniable charisma. Uh-huh. Like him or not, he has this charisma that makes you love him.
Mm-hmm.
In real life, that could change on a dime, and he could get really mean.
That's what I've heard.
So yeah. This is him using that charisma as an entertainer. We shouldn't It's hard to, you know. We're talking about him as an entertainer.
Sure.
He used it like crazy on the stage and was a master of it. It's too bad about his real life.
Yeah.
But I would think most comics put this right up there. I would.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, but knowing the history of comedy albums, this has to be in the top 10. I mean, surely, right?
I think so. I think it's one that no one's brought up.
Yeah, it's certainly his in the top 5 of Richard Pryor records. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
This is him at his peak, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's no... It is just pure comedy, because there are some people who are at their peak when they're also super tight, super smooth. They've got all their ducks in a row, and he does. But it does... Again, he's one of those guys who can have a tight set, and it doesn't sound it. In that, again, it seems folksy. Because it's so story. You know,
it does seem
story
folksy and spontaneous and fresh as hell.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like he's just riffing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 10% of it is riffing.
Sure.
You know, but it's all structured, you know.
Oh, yeah. And
he's a total pro, and he, you know, he really delivers, you know.
He's one of those guys whose heads I've never been able to delve into, because I've never heard, because there was a time during, like, when Steve Martin did Wild and Crazy Guy, where there's this whole record they released to promote that album, where half of the record is him talking about it and talking about his process. I've never heard Richard Pryor talk about it, so I want to know. I'd love to know how much of this was him. You know, how much of this was on the stage and how much of it was beforehand. But that's one of those things you don't get to know about him. And
No.
It's okay. That mystery's fine with me, but it would be interesting to know.
Mm-hmm.
I had these monkeys up. There was squirrel monkeys. A friend gave me 2. You ever seen them, the squirrel monkeys? And he gave me 1. I called it Friend. Because the first time I opened the cage, he ran up my arm and stuck his dick in my ear. And it felt like a wet Q-tip, right? And there wasn't no action for him. He got mad. He just pissed all on my cheek. And I grabbed that motherfucker. I threw him up to the ceiling. He grabbed the chandelier. I'm like,
thought you had me, didn't you?
Did it one time. This guy was going to do a movie with me, and he came over to the house and said, can I open the gate? I said, no!
And very funny, Rich. You won't be doing any films at Warner Brothers, that's for goddamn sure, buddy. You want to get this monkey stick out of my ear?
One thing, too, that strikes me about the documentary, to bring it back a little bit to that, is that I don't, because I'm not a painter. I mean, I'm a cartoonist. I do little bits here and there, okay? But I'm not a painter. So I don't know how you go about applying essentially the same principles to not standing up, to not improvising. I mean, is there some improvisation to what you do?
Because, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it if I couldn't improvise. Mm-hmm. You know, improvisation is the whole spark for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you got to have a plan once the ball starts rolling, but mm-hmm. to get an idea, I have to improvise. You know, and I think that's true of any creative process.
Yeah.
If it's not improvised, then what is it? Where does it come from?
Sure.
It comes from that's what these word paintings I've been doing for 14 years. That started as an improvised idea.
Yeah.
A spur of the moment thing that I just wanted to try. You mm-hmm. know, a comedy riff, supposedly, that I'm still doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's why I've always thought of comedy and art as related, very much so, you know, because they are about improvising. Art, for me, is improvising.
Sure.
And the best kind of comedy can be, start with an idea, but you can riff on it and make it funnier.
Yeah.
You can always riff.
Of course.
Always riffing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you more prone to stick with your first idea for what words you're going to paint on the landscape that you find?
Well, I sort of approach that as a writer. I write little phrases in a book, and I edit it way, way down.
Right.
Sometimes it comes out perfect, mm-hmm. with a short burst. I'm a frustrated writer. I wish I had the discipline and talent to write prose, but I can't. It just comes out in little short bursts, you know, and I take advantage of that at least, and put them in paintings and transform them into painted forms, and, you know, it's all entangled with vision and visual and word and blah, blah, blah. But underneath it all, I'm still about capturing this weird quality that comedy captures. This sudden, sharp surprise that makes you laugh.
Yeah.
Which is the hardest thing to do in the world.
Which is why some people treat it like it would be easy to look at a painting of yours and maybe treat it as frivolous because it looks so... It's just plain letters, so it seems. Obviously, there's a lot of skill that goes into it that people don't appreciate it, but that's just... That's one of the things about comedy, too, is that just because it's a joke doesn't mean there wasn't a shitload of work and thought put into it.
Yes, you're on a knife's edge, you know? I mean, it's a balancing act. It's an insight into human nature. It's a million things. It takes quite a mind to figure it out. And it's some high level thinking, you know? And maybe it's a fool's errand to try to be funny in the art world. I don't know. But there's no other alternative for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not always trying to be funny, too. I'm trying to layer it.
Sure.
I'm not trying to be a silly gag man all the time.
Right, right.
I think I'm trying to tell a story. You know, I'm not just trying to deliver punchlines. And if it's funny or if it appeals to people as funny, that's great. I think funny is a great communicator.
Yeah.
And let's face it, the art world is so prissy. I can't help myself. It's ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, it's a parody of itself. When you do a parody of it, you know, it's just a recreation of it.
I know a friend
it parodies itself.
Yeah.
So, but, and maybe it's, you know, I don't know, shooting fish in a barrel, but it's fun to just let your hair down in the art world and try to be yourself. And
yeah.
Be funny.
But you have to not worry about why people like it, though, right? Is that...
Absolutely. And that's your hardest passage through youth. And I still worry about what people like. Everybody does. You never get over that.
Sure, sure.
We're social, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're in a civilization. You can't ever get over it. But you try, and, you know, you try. They also say there's no willpower. There's no human will. Mm-hmm. Everything's preordained.
Right, right.
And that we're just kind of these meat robots, you know? And I think art is a doomed effort to prove that wrong.
Yeah.
To second guess that.
Yeah.
To second guess everything.
Right.
To keep trying to dodge and dart around the same old preconceived shit, you know? And that's what comedy does, too. It dodges and darts around and finds a new way to squirrel its way into civilization as a record of what's really going on instead of just the same old preconceived, ready-made shit.
It can be hard, too, because, like, as a comedy writer, I know that, like, I sometimes get caught up in the whole idea of wanting to have meaning in what I write. And you do forget that in comedy, at least, the laugh is the most important thing. And we talk about that a lot on this show, because, I can get pretentious pretty easy, and I don't want to.
I find it impossible to put any kind of meaning into my work. If it's there, it comes out because I was just being honest with myself.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a collateral thing, or it's just something that happens on its own accord.
Sure.
You can't, like, spoon out meaning into your work like it's a recipe.
That becomes the problem. Like, I think when you're at least when I went to art school, when you were learning this structure that, at the very least, I hated, because I'm like, don't you fucking tell me how to write. But I was wrong in that. I should have at least taken a little bit of that advice. I at some point just turned a complete 180, and I started trying to twist the meaning and the subtext of shit rather than just twist the format and let the subtext and shit come out. Do you understand? Does that make sense?
Well, you're going into it with a big idea that you were going to try to make work because it was a really, really great idea.
Of course. Oh, they all were.
You know what? Some people can maybe do that. I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know. Most of the, I don't know. I can't, I don't know. We all know, I mean, you write comedy.
I do.
And you're a teacher.
She's a teacher.
There's a silent person
and an artist
sitting here.
And a wonderful artist. Photographer.
So we're all creative. We all know the creative process.
Sure.
It's really hard to get a... It most of the time, you don't go, oh, this is a brilliant idea.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah.
You just have a kind of a dumb idea that's uh-huh. kind of half formed.
Yeah.
And you jump it anyway because time's running out.
Yeah.
On a local level and on a cosmic level. So you just jump in.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets better as you work at it.
Yeah.
You know, for me it does. I can't preconceive hardly anything.
Loving that process is really hard for people.
All my ideas are really simple.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They can be all understood by a 10-year-old,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I do with them in the process that makes them what they are.
Yeah, not everybody could do that thing that appeals to a 10-year-old.
It's the same with comedy. All comedy concepts are very, very basic and simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's how you tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the new stuff you find. It has to be new, too. Comedy needs that, you know. It's always the new, what new stuff can this guy tell me about? You know, man, that's hard.
It's really rough. Did you go out of your way after you listened to this album to hunt down more Richard Pryor? I mean, he was there. He was just there, so I guess...
To tell you the truth, I couldn't afford to buy records back then. I was a broke student.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't afford to buy hard... You know, I would listen to my friends' records and stuff.
Yeah. No, that's good, though.
Completely. So I did... I did go see his movies, though.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the movie of this,
mm-hmm.
of course, and then rented them all through the 80s when video came out. And of course, and then his whole tragic movie career of the 80s.
Yeah.
I saw his concert films, though, and I always liked them.
Mm-hmm.
And but I always remember him because of this record and that one time at Bill's house when we all sat around and listened to it and had such a great time laughing at it.
Yeah.
Did you
make friends over, I mean, I know the answer to the art part because I've seen the documentary, but did you ever make friends over comedy, or was it something that you regularly got to share with friends, like, hey, have you heard this, or isn't this funny as hell, we both like this, now we're friends?
I can't remember comedy actually
mm-hmm.
being the spur for that, but it was definitely, and it still is, I know it, especially in LA, it's a huge bonding thing with
sure.
people.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. Everybody loves the hot, new, funny stuff. You know, everybody bonds over Louis C.K. and
sure.
Saturday Night Live, of course, in the late 70s was the cool thing. And but I don't think I ever hit it off with somebody because we both agreed something was funny.
Has that ever been important to you that somebody else think the same thing is funny as you?
It's a sort of a deal breaker when somebody thinks something stupid is funny.
Okay. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, it really sours things fast. I'm subtle about it. I can slowly break it off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah. Sense of humor is really important to me. I think it's a real gauge.
Mm-hmm.
Of everything.
You know, my grandma would discipline me, I mean, beat my ass. I deserved them too. She used to beat my ass. Remember them switches you used to have to go get yourself to beat your own ass with? And they had them leaves on you to go. I see them trees today. I stopped the car and get out the car to kill that motherfucker. Right? I see what I say. You won't grow up, you motherfucker. Because that was some hell of a psychology, right? To make you go get a switch to beat your own ass with. Right? My grandma said, boy, go get me something to beat your ass with. And that would be the longest walk in the world. Yeah, you'd be the one. And you knew you couldn't come back with no little one either. Because if you come back with a little one, she's going out there and get the tree and beat your ass with it. Right, you'd be going in the house, that vine makes such a weird sound in your ear, you'd be doing, it make you start crying before you get in the house, right? Mama! Mama, I'm dead no more, mama, 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 mama.
It's got to be hard then to make friends in the art world, I have to imagine.
It can be. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
A lot of artists have a great sense of humor, but their work is very serious.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it always kind of confuses me too, just like when I was a kid, you'd be in church and all these regular acting adults would suddenly act very, very strange, like they were being hypnotized. You'd think, what the fuck is going on here? It's the same with the art world, you know. There's these drunken painters and stuff, and then the gallery show comes up, and it's like, Amadea, Amadea, the temple of art is calling. The temple of art is calling. And they're flagellating themselves over in the corner.
With paintbrushes. I want to say that that doesn't exist in comedy, but I think I'm wrong.
Well, there's some... You mean like people have a righteous attitude about
That act that you put on with your peers when you're the center of attention, or when you want to be the center of attention, even if it's somebody else's show.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with performers and people who want to be funny. They need attention very badly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's why they're doing it, you know, from a lack of love or just from the sheer adrenaline of how they can make people laugh.
Uh-huh.
I know the feeling, you know.
Sure.
I've got to experience it myself when this movie came out. Suddenly I was the center of attention for about a year on the road. You know, every city I'd go to, there'd be a party waiting for me.
Yeah.
You know? So I got to experience a little bit of celebrity myself and know the dangers of that. For the personality.
Yeah.
You know? If you bask in the spotlight too long, you know, it will burn you up.
Yeah.
You have to be careful about it. But it's still a great place where great art is made. The spotlight with comedy and music, performance, movies, live music, live comedy. They're all incredibly powerful art forms.
Yeah.
You know, especially the movies. Jesus. I learned that firsthand myself.
Sure.
You know, people see that movie and they're like, they fall in love with you. They had never met you.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they think they know you.
Of course.
They come to your house and you say, get the hell out of here. I don't want to see you kids around here anymore with your solar power initiatives. And yet they come back. Bastards. I told them no. Anyway. So the power of movies, comedy, music, incredible art forms. And I like to get a little of that heat into the art world somehow, because I've been around it for so long. I worked in TV for 25 years. I worked with writers and comedians and whatnot.
Yeah. I can't shake it. Understandable. But you're a performer too, and is it a natural, easy transition
between
the two?
It is. I've been a latent ham for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got into performing professionally with Pee Wee as a puppeteer in the 80s and 86. I've been in SAG ever since then, but I never really pursued it. I got jobs in puppeteering when it fell into my lap when I was designing the show, and I just kind of sneak in as a puppeteer too.
Yeah.
I call it acting while hiding.
It's perfect.
But this movie project and experience brought that ham back out and put me center stage, put me in the spotlight. And Neil Berkeley, the director, who I must emphasize, that was a Neil Berkeley production.
Yeah.
That's why it was so popular. That's why it was so good.
He did a brilliant job.
He made me look great, and he did a good job at it. You got to understand, you know, it's not mine. I didn't make it.
Oh, I know.
I was just like,
I'm trying to get him on the show.
Half numb participant. So it's a Neil Berkeley success in every way. Anyway, he encouraged me. We put together that show that's in the movie, that's the narrative through story there. He encouraged me to do that show, which I still do. It's like an hour-long stage monologue with slides and animation and puppets and banjo and stuff. And so, he brought that back out of me. And I do have a knack for doing that. I don't know why or how, but I just do. I never get stage fright at all. Nothing... A crowd of people don't intimidate me. I find it an interesting experience to try to manipulate them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another kind of art project for me, in a way. And I'll do it from time to time, less and less. now because I'm just kind of, that's enough.
Of course.
It's enough of the stage life and mm-hmm. the grease paint and the, you know.
Well, you don't want to work forever on the same painting either.
I mean, my default position is I'm an artist who draws and paints, you know. It's incredible that I got to live this life as a performer and as a quasi-celebrity movie personality. But, I'm lucky. I'm lucky to have lived it. It's yet another experience.
Is it just Richard Pryor's stage presence that pulls you in on this, or is it something specific about the stories, or something specific about the stories he tells about himself?
No, we're talking about me. Forget Richard Pryor.
Who is that guy?
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, are you kidding?
There's just something specific about him.
Yeah, I mean, is there something about him that draws you in? Is there something specific you're relating to?
It's the emotion.
It's just the emotion. I say just, but that's silly.
It is. It's his genius for communicating emotion, mm-hmm. whether it's anger, mm-hmm. fear, like I said earlier. He is an emotional genius, like all great performers, like all great singers, like Hank Williams or George Jones or Frank Sinatra or Richard Pryor. They can put over this emotion on the stage. Mm-hmm. And all, you know, great actors do it. You know, it's the greatest chop an act and a comedian, a stand-up comedian, is an actor, especially in concert like this.
Yeah,
it's the greatest chop they have is to bring up an emotion and make you feel that same emotion. That's mm-hmm. really hard to do.
Yeah,
you know, because it usually just gets sentimental.
Sure,
or you can see right through it. This guy, you feel like he's feeling that stuff.
100%.
You know? And so, yeah, that's a rare, rare quality.
I mean, even the bit about the monkeys dying, like, when he is doing that crying, much as it's supposed to be comical crying, there's a bit there where I bought it.
You totally buy everything he says.
You know?
Like it or not.
Yeah.
Agree with him or not. Politically correct or not.
Sure.
Yeah, you're with him every bit of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a charisma that he was born with, but it's also professionalism that he crafted. And I've seen a little bit of that myself, experienced that as a being on the stage and how to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an extra dimension to what he has.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. So, yeah, I would say I identify with the pure emotion of mm-hmm. it all. Not the great high, not the incredible intellectual concept like a George Carlin would have. Not even the conceptualism of a Steve Martin.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
It's just raw. It's just raw. And Eddie Murphy. You know, mm-hmm. he owns everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Uh huh.
In fact, he used to do straight up Richard Pryor.
I know.
Bits.
I know.
You know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's why I said raw. Oh, Eddie Murphy. Anyway, this is raw. This is the real raw.
What do you do? I mean, I know what he does to harness it. He's an actor, and he's drawing for. And you're obviously going to be drawing from your own stuff. But how do you harness that and then translate it? Because there's a lot of patience to doing that with a painting that's going to take you hours and hours and hours and hours to do.
I'm not quite sure I'd do the same thing.
Sure.
It's a way different process. Like if I want to do something raw from the gut, and I will do it up in the most fanciest type, like, you know, mm-hmm. try to get the most frisson
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
possible, the most conflicting things, and spin it that way. Like if it's completely vile, disgusting, then I'll write it in the most beautiful type I can. Mm-hmm. You know, some basic. Push and pull contrasty thing that makes all drama work, you know, yin
sure.
and yang and all that stuff. So it can't be as straightforward as the human voice. That's what comedy uses, is the voice. So I'm not using a human voice. I'm using like these forms so that I carefully paint. So I don't know. Sometimes I think it's a fool's errand to try to be funny with a painted form, you know, because mm-hmm. it's not about timing, but by the end, it's just about a kind of a, maybe it's a gimmick by the end, I don't know. But I don't know. That's the mystery of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mystery of anything that's, like I said before, of catching you by surprise and making you laugh. It's really hard to surprise people. That's all a laugh really is a surprise. You think they're going to turn left and they turn right. It tickles you.
Anybody here ever had a heart attack? No, a motherfucker never admit they had a heart attack, right, people?
No, sir, I never did. I had indigestion one time.
That motherfucker's hype. I don't care what nobody tell your ass, boy. I was walking in the yard and somebody said,
"Don't breathe no more." I said, "Huh?" I said, "Don't breathe no motherfucking more. You heard me. Okay, I won't breathe, I won't breathe, I won't breathe."
And I tried to ease a little air inside of my mouth. And I said, "Say, motherfucker, did I tell you not to breathe?
You told me not to breathe, you told me not to breathe.
Well, where you going? Why are you walking? Stand still, motherfucker."
"Okay, I'll stand still. Get your ass down." "Okay, I'm down, I'm down, I'm down. Don't hurt me, don't hurt me, don't hurt me."
"Shut the fuck up. You think about dying, aren't you?"
"Yeah, yeah."
"Why didn't you think about that when you was eating that pork, motherfucker?" "I don't know." "Drinking that whiskey and snorting that cocaine, nigga. I didn't think about it. Shut the fuck up." I'll shut up. "You ain't shut up yet." That's when you put an emergency call in to God. "Please, this is emergency. Can I talk to God?"
"I'll have to put you on hold."
And your heart gets mad if it finds out you was going behind his back trying to talk to God.
"Was you trying to talk to God?"
"No, I wasn't. You was a lying motherfucker."
Have there been people from other cultures for whom it has said different things, or that you just because typography might mean something different elsewhere, where what you think is a flowing and pretty font might mean something else to somebody? I'm just curious. I mean, I don't know if anybody's ever.
Typography is an endless mystery too. It's a great subject for art making, just like the figure or the landscape or any of the other great themes.
Mm-hmm.
The forms of letter forms are endlessly great and fascinating. I'm not sure. I'm not intellectual enough to answer that. I mean, I don't really know. I just love I just love letter forms, and I love the fact that they're pictures that talk. You know? And so I guess I am striving towards a voice. You know, I'm striving towards an implied voice.
Sure.
In your head.
Yeah.
You know, and the way the letters are designed is the accent or the plummy or reedy or hickey or neutral tone that voice will have.
Yeah.
Then there's the straight up content. And that's why I guess also that's why I love going to do the word paintings, and they've appealed to me and I keep doing them. Is like, I got so tired of like symbols and metaphors and ambiguity, and it's like, why can't I just put the content straight out there? Here it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know? There it is. Don't have to worry about it. Now I can concentrate on making it pretty and coloring it in just right. And I'm not having to worry about content the whole time I'm doing the formal picture-making part of it.
Because
that's it. Bang. Mm-hmm. You know? Done. You know? Why can't that happen in art? Why do you always have to beat around the bush?
Yeah.
You know? Why do you always have to like be tweaking something into like ambiguity? So that was another big issue besides just the humor and working with type, is just being like a plain-spoken American, if I could, with it all. I was just so tired of the indirection.
Yeah.
That then you find that there's always a level of indirection.
Yeah.
That's what makes it art. You can't just like be direct. But I was wondering if you could be direct and be indirect at the same time. You know?
Sure.
I don't know.
I just like that when I first looked at one of your paintings, I didn't know it was you. I mean, I just saw it at Fred 62. Like, I realized that while a lot of stuff was all caps and huge, that I don't know how somebody else might read that, because like, I would assume that it looks like yelling to most people.
A lot of it looks like yelling.
But then I'm also like, it's so, some because it's going with, sometimes it just goes with the landscape, it seems so gentle that way and so natural. I don't know. I try to do
a lot of like, you know, conflicting layers that build up interest and spark, you know, keep it lively.
Sure.
You know, but that's how any good piece of art is. It's got conflicting stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be about harmony. It has to be. The engine is always the protagonist and the antagonist, you know. So that's true of all art forms. And So, but I do think of the style of the type as the tone of the voice.
And
I guess I was sort of working towards just a voice. And that's what a lot of people call a vision in art or a particular style. Well, that's his voice. He found his or her voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's her voice. I'm so glad you found your voice with your narrative. You know, it's never a story. It's a narrative. It's never words. It's text. The text and your narrative and your voice and the practice. Your practice. You're not making art. It's your practice. So it's just so silly, silly, silly.
I know. Anyway, when, again, this guy can get up on stage, do something that seems perfectly unrehearsed and blow your mind.
And it's doing the same thing that any art does. It's touching you as a human.
Yeah.
You know? What more do you want? You know? So, you know, comedy is art. Definitely.
Yeah. Usually this far into the episode.
There, everybody can rest easy now.
Yeah, now we've solved the problem, finally.
Yeah. Okay.
Wayne White has solved it. Normally I ask people when we're this far in if nobody's ever heard this album before or doesn't know much about Richard Pryor, because, you know, I guess anybody's in danger of falling out of public favor or public interest. Can you condense, besides a monkey having sex with his ear, why this is a good album to listen to? Maybe a good first album.
I think this is a good introduction to Richard Pryor. Like I said, it's him at his career peak as a stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
He started getting real big problems after 78. I just read in the bio, you know, his grandmother died and things started going downhill fast for him. So
This
was him hitting it at his best. So this is, just timing-wise, this is good. And like I said before, it's about telling stories. This is just a great storytelling record.
Yeah.
You don't even think of them as, I see them listed here as bits, but in my mind, it's just a flowing story of one thing. And they're even broken up. You can hear the tracks start and stop.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, it'll always just be a guy telling a story that just kind of weaves in and out of different topics. So just for a guy at his peak, telling stories to a crowd and killing it, mm-hmm. I mean, this is it. And it's also a great document of the change in comedy and culture in the 70s and the way that a black performer could break through. And this is he's the greatest.
Yeah. And even with all the sort of disparate types of stories he's telling, there's a lot about family in it, I noticed. Like,
yes.
I don't think there's one track that goes by without a mention of family or relationships, or because, you know, his own marriage seemed to be quite on the rocks at the time. So.
And he always plays it less than noble every time. He's 100%. Never the hero of the story, 100%. Which is so great.
Yeah.
You know, which is one of the great comic personas, you know. It's the anti-hero.
Yeah.
And but he's played just right. Too bad he couldn't play it better in real life.
Right.
He plays it perfect on stage. It's a pitch-perfect performance. It really is. And it's just... Yeah.
I also like to make sure that people know where they can find you. Your website is it WayneWhiteArt.com?
Yes.
It is WayneWhiteArt.com.
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
On Twitter.
Yeah, and I have a rollicking Instagram.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It's called Wayne White Art also.
So much good stuff on there.
Yeah, it's fresh eyeball rides every day.
The Civil War stuff kind of blew my mind. That kind of hurt my brain. It was fantastic. How tall were those?
15, 16 feet tall. I just did some 15-foot tall puppets in New York.
Really?
There's a show up right now, up through October 11th at Joshua Liner Gallery. And it's my biggest show in New York. It's in Chelsea on West 28th Street.
Mm-hmm.
I did two, the Lubin Brothers. I don't know if you know
who they are,
the country music act of the brothers.
Oh, I did see one of the covers you posted.
Yeah, those are big, big ass puppets.
Yeah.
I built them right there in the gallery. So if you're in New York, check that out.
Are they mixed, or are they all cardboard? It looked like all cardboard.
They're all cardboard.
That's
mostly
crazy.
Cardboard and wood. I build them right there in the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Plus there'll be my word paintings or my narrative texts. And then my work on paper too.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of drawings and watercolors on paper.
Awesome.
So it's a big three-ring circus of what I do, and it's great to be back in Chelsea.
That's so cool.
Showing in New York again.
That's awesome.
It's been a little while. So, and it's great to praise this record. I highly recommend it to anybody. It's funny. You'll laugh, and you might even get a little teary-eyed.
I think so. I think so. I got to make sure I pick. Normally, I pick really funny clips, but I think there are a couple bits that stand listening to just for pure emotion.
Yeah. Yeah, the heart attack and the monkey.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. You do. You feel like you start, when he talks about the heart attack, like, I can't breathe. Like, it was trouble. I had trouble breathing because that's all he's talking about for 2 minutes straight.
Yeah.
It's like, don't breathe. What are you doing?
I told you. I didn't think about that when you were eating that pork.
Oh, God. It's so, and it's simultaneously just fucking hilarious, but painful. Painful.
Jesus.
Thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome.
It's been a lot of fun.
Hey, my pleasure.
Everybody, thank you for listening. Wayne, thank you for being here. And everybody, as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.